You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 8th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
A city that's in love with paper, an editor who's become the toast of the periodical world, our man in the Pacific Northwest, and a good coffee on top of that. Get your Berkeys on, The Stack's in Portland. Also ahead on the program, we'll tour the aisles of an outstanding purveyor of mags up the coast in Seattle.
Every time I see an ad on the back of a Condé Nast publication saying that you could see the same thing on an iPad, it really like kills me.
That was the chief magazine officer at Bulldog News up the coast in Seattle. And our Zach Dundas will be telling us about local reading habits.
So this is a city where, you know, along with getting, you know, a great cappuccino, you can have a good chat about books and magazines and find a receptive interlocutor no matter what you want to talk about.
All that over the next 50 minutes or so right here on The Stack on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 41 of The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brulé. Today we're coming to you from the lobby high above the Ace Hotel, and we're feeling pretty good about the state of magazines in this part of the U.S., as plenty of people are not just devouring magazines, but also creating them. In a moment, we'll meet one such gentleman, but before that, a tip. If you get a chance, you must pay a visit to Rich's Tobacco Store for a proper stock-up on magazines. I've already paid a visit, which means we're ready to get rolling here. Here's who's around the table. Well, joining us around this very fine table here at the Ace Hotel is Nathan Williams, a name maybe not as famous as the title, at least not yet anyway. Of course, Kinfolk magazine comes up very frequently, and certainly has done so over the last 40 programs or so. Based here, but hails not just from my mother country, but we're both prairie boys, it seems. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tyler.
Tell me, is there something about sort of the Canadian condition of maybe sort of growing up, you know, in the provinces of, you know, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and certainly Alberta, that you know, maybe as a young child, there was those long winter nights, etc., that forced you to spend a lot of time with magazines and got you into this gig, or was it something else?
That may have been part of it. The weather definitely keeps us indoors and forces us to be a bit more creative with how we entertain and spend time with each other, so perhaps.
As I said at the beginning of this, the magazine has really set the world on fire. So many reviewers talk about it on the program. But in the editor's own words, distill Kinfolk for us, and maybe let's just rewind a little bit. What was the starting point for launching it?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Kinfolk is a quarterly lifestyle magazine, and for anyone reading it for the first time, the subtitle kind of hints at the main purpose, which is now discovering new things to cook, make, and do. So it's an entertaining magazine, but the intention from the beginning has been to introduce a new idea of entertaining that's a bit more casual and intentional and meaningful. And kind of the second part of the goal has been for us to help that idea of casual entertaining feel a bit more natural and approachable for a younger generation, kind of a younger crowd like myself and my friends. So it actually started with a few friends in our last year of university. We kind of enjoyed hanging out and kind of cooking together and you know, testing out recipes, and there wasn't really a title that, I don't know, seemed to resonate with us. Mm. And
did it start off as really a kitchen table publishing venture in that respect, or not? It sounds like we're going to, speaking of all things domestic, that we're going to be devoured by a Hoover at any moment. We're going to try to get rid of that, but we'll press on. Look, we just lost it. There you go. I'm not sure what they did with him, the poor Hoover operator. Nevertheless, just going back to that, Nathan. Yeah, how was it sort of an environment like the one we're in right now that you started publishing it, or?
Yeah, I mean, it actually was quite casual. We started the first issue with a focus on a digital edition. So we launched it online, and the intention was kind of just to test the market and see if there was interest for a title that we were interested in as friends. And so after we launched the digital edition, there was quite a welcome, warm response to it. And so we used that as kind of proof of the market. and then kind of started talking with publishers, and they approached us, and that kind of, there was a publisher in San Francisco, well-known, that kind of took us under their wings and helped us to kind of learn the ropes of printing and distribution and kind of get ourselves out there.
I also want to introduce my colleague, Zach Dundas, a voice that many people, of course, will know. Wrapping up our Cascadia tour yesterday, he joined us on the program. We looked through a number of newspaper titles, both dailies and some of the weeklies. We're going to move on from that. But of course, Zach doesn't just earn his keep with us. You are also a senior editor at the Portland Monthly, which is. I always find quite fascinating that the U.S. is quite famous for all of these city monthlies. Mm-hmm. Yes. You can really travel the world, but it's one of the peculiarities almost of U.S. publishing that there's still so many cities that have not just one, maybe two or three glossy titles which represent the urban landscape. So within that, Zach, where does the Portland Monthly pitch itself?
Well, it is a very interesting niche that does exist in most major metropolitan areas. And in some ways, the magazines are throwbacks to what American magazines used to be, which is a big tent for a big readership. You're trying to appeal to mom, you're trying to appeal to dad, you're trying to have something cool for the kids to look at. And in the same way that maybe Life magazine for a different era attempted to capture a pretty broad swath of its world, we try to capture a pretty broad swath of our world. Our world is the city of Portland and its immediate environment, or environs rather. So it's rather a small world, but we try to go fairly deep within it. So we try to be a magazine that people at different levels of the socioeconomic ladder, people of different demographic backgrounds, would find equally useful and interesting to read, which I think is quite different to what most of magazine publishing has become, which if you go to any newsstand, you can almost imagine what the pitch was for each magazine, each new title. This will be great for guys who love to buy lots of gear, or, this will be for the woman who wants to, be the most fit woman in her yoga class. So, we are perhaps the opposite of that. Of course, we have our demographic target, and what we like to tell our advertisers, our readers, are all about, which is, they're very engaged Portlanders who like to sample all the good things the city has to offer. But we're the big tent of local media. Mm.
We're in a small, smallish by urban standards, metropolitan market. This is not the biggest city on this coast. Nevertheless, it is one which is so well known for quality of life. It does very well, of course, in our rankings. I won't give it away yet, but sometime in the next sort of 96 hours, listeners, you will probably hear where the city comes out and who's going to be number one as well. Are you alone in this as being one of the monthlies in this small market, or do you have competition as well?
We don't have a direct competitor in Portland. The company that owns the magazine publishes a magazine in Seattle, which is essentially the same concept. There they have fierce competition. There's another monthly. They go at it. They try to preempt one another. There's covers. There's all kinds of interesting skullduggery that goes on, just in terms of direct commercial competition.
I mean, do you actually miss that? I mean, I always think that a bit of competition is good for keeping you on your toes.
There are days when I do think it would be great, just to have that anvil to sharpen your sword on. But on the other hand, Portland had, for generations, a reputation being a city that couldn't support a magazine for not being... It was not big enough. It was not rich enough. So I think... One is enough for now.
I want to talk to both of you about the gentrification of the city, and it is amazing. Yesterday, when we were doing the Monocle Daily, and we had Karen Brooks was on our program, who was talking about food, and she talked about this being a city which maybe doesn't have let's say the financial wherewithal amongst its citizens for fine dining. Maybe one could sort of say it's just not the appetite for it, but it does strike you as a city, nevertheless, which has pretty deep pockets. And I'm wondering, does that create an environment? Certainly, when you look at local newsstands, but also in local publishing, is it a reasonably easy, do you think, still for for your title to find advertisers, and you yesterday you talked about some of the weeklies in the city, or is it a tough environment?
I think it can be tough depending on the fluctuation of the moment in the economy. The Portland Monthly historically did quite well off real estate advertising and home and shelter advertising. And when the financial meltdown and the attendant property market meltdown of 2008 hit, they almost had to relaunch, in a sense, the kind of advertising that they were after. Mm. But, you know, in terms of what the sort of economic base for the magazine is, we do not have in Portland the kind of wealth. Of course, we have some very wealthy people, but by and large, we do not have the kind of wealth that you find in Vancouver, the kind of wealth that you find in San Francisco, certainly. Los Angeles, you know, these are just cities with more money.
Are you leaving Seattle deliberately?
No, they also have more money than us, which they will be the first to tell you, right. You know, I was just in Vancouver interviewing the mayor for Monocle, and he said that a major challenge that he faces, aside from his perennial disagreements with the federal and provincial governments, is the fact that Vancouver is just a very expensive place to live, and everything is expensive there, and so every city initiative has a very high price tag. Portland has always found itself a niche as the cheap West Coast city, you know, the place where you would like to live and can afford to live. Mm. Now, that, of course, has some implications, you know, if you're trying to make a living as a magazine publisher. You know, it makes things a little bit more challenging, but it's also been the key to all the culture that we cover.
Right.
So it gives and takes away, I guess.
Nathan, I don't want to get too personal, but is that one of the reasons that you're here? Because it's maybe the barrier for entry is not as high, or are there other personal reasons that you're in Portland with the magazine?
No, I mean, it's definitely easier to set up shop in an office here, which is why we are here with Kinfolk. But I mean, the city itself, Portland's never been a city for our strongest sales for the magazine. It just hasn't been. But I mean, the culture here, the food, the restaurants, it's good for a small young startup like ourselves, where we can actually get out and enjoy good food that is still at a reasonable price. I'm hoping that doesn't skyrocket anytime soon.
No. Just from a media environment perspective and finding talent, and of course, you know, people who know the magazine, you know, you are of course shooting all over the world, but of course this is the place where everything gets assembled at the end of the day. Do you have maybe a certain luxury as an editor being here, that you're not in New York and you're not in London, and you know, I always think that sometimes the curse that comes with being in those cities, that there is a certain arrogance because you are in a major center where maybe advertising is a little bit easier in those markets, and talent is definitely easy to come by. So I'm wondering if it gives you a different type of editorial tension being in a market like this.
I hope so, and I mean with Kinfolk and kind of the purpose and the mission behind it, we do hope to keep kind of a slow, intentional, kind of a different vibe to it. And so I hope that having that distance might help with that, so it feels a bit different. But at the same time, there are challenges to not being in a larger city like New York and London. As we are working on stories and shoots, resources just aren't kind of at our disposal here. And so we do have kind of our go-to team and kind of the same photographers that we work with often. Although we do, try and branch out by finding new talent elsewhere.
So. Yeah. Let's go back a little bit earlier. You said that, you know, the original idea was to do something as, you know, digitally to launch. I guess you were thinking probably as a tablet edition very early on, or just that Kinfolk was going to live as, as a sort of, you know, very engaged website. And so what was the turning point that said we're actually going to do a magazine? Was it something, a specific trigger?
No, actually, the intention was never for it to stay online. The intention is that it would be a print magazine, but we didn't have the capital to just jump right into that, and so we decided that we would start kind of the digital issue as a test issue to throw it out there. I think we did a small print run of like 500 copies that we send out to contributors, and then we sold through the website as well. But again, yeah, it was just kind of a way to prove if there was interest, and then use that to kind of grow.
Are you surprised by, and as you said, you know, this is the market you happen to be based in, but just the international reception and really, you know, the fandom that I see when I'm in Japan, I was in Taiwan the week before last, that, you know, you've really hit upon something, and what do you think that something is?
I really have no idea. I mean, it's a concept that really resonates strongly with us. You know, this casual approach to entertaining, and I guess it's my hope, and it seems like that does also connect with other people. And But as far as the growth and the quick growth over the last 2 years, I really can't point my finger on it.
Okay, well, that's your job, Zach. What do you think Nathan has done? And maybe, you know, of course, springing from this market, but internationally, what do you see?
Well, you know, Kinfolk does so brilliantly is it distills a whole idea that is almost implicit when you read it and look at the photos and read the stories. I mean, you don't need to read some sort of mission statement or grandiose overarching declaration of what the magazine is about to really understand where you're coming from. And that, I think, in an interesting way, is something that magazines are distinctly and almost uniquely good for. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have this whole collection of disparate content that's united by one sensibility or an idea or a visual aesthetic, and Kinfolk has refined that into something really quite beautiful. And as Nathan says, it's approachable, but it's also aspirational. I mean, everything looks great. Everyone looks like they're having a great time. It is, in some ways, fantasy is the wrong word, but it looks like something to aspire to. And I think that that is really the key to it.
There does seem to be kind of a general appetite in the market for similar titles. I mean, Kinfolk isn't the only one in the Food Quarterly kind of rack right now, and there have been a lot that have popped up recently that have also kind of impressed our team that we've been going through as well. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what it is and why they've been popping up, but it seems like the new quarterlies, you know, there's Gather, there's Serial, there's The Gourmand, there's Fool Magazine. I mean, the independent food magazine market, I don't know why it's booming right now, but it seems to be doing quite well.
Mm. Well, we'll try to answer that question and maybe a few others. You're listening to a very special edition of The Stack. Of course, we have Nathan Williams around the table, of course, who is the editor of Kinfolk, and also our very own Zach Dundas is here with us. We're going away for a very short break. We're back in a moment.
For centuries, Sulaymaniyah has been a magnet for artists. On assignment in northern Iraq, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield met with would-be hip-hop artists, painters, and poets to discover the city's new creative wave.
Kurdistan exists, and yet it doesn't. It's a country, and yet it isn't. It has a soul, though, and a culture, and that's a start. And if that soul, that culture, is to be found anywhere, it is found here in Sulaymaniyah, a city of more than a million in the northeast of Iraq.
The Soul of Sulaymaniyah, a photographic essay on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to The Stack here on Monocle 24. A very special edition. We're coming to you from just above the lobby of the Ace Hotel downtown in Portland. Of course, wrapping up a week that saw a couple of us. I think there was probably 8 or 9 of us on the road kicking off in Victoria. No, not Victoria, Vancouver. Victoria, of course, being the capital of British Columbia. Then we were in Seattle. Now in Portland today, and we're joined by Zach Dundas. And also Nathan Williams of Kinfolk magazine. Just before we went to the break, we were talking about just this whole surge in titles focused on entertaining and food and drink, and it's not something which has been confined to this coast or this country. You know, we've seen great things happening across the border in Canada. You know, Serial comes from, you know, Bristol of all places. You know, great stuff coming out of Australia. You know, all over the place. I just, Zach, you know, here we are sitting in one, you know, one region, and I let's extend the region all the way down to the valley, and maybe even, you know, further south, where there's, you know, there's so much focus on digital. There is so much focus on, at the same time, you know, a lot of people seeing what's happening here, which, you know, leads them to talk and to really sort of sound the death knell for print, etc. But yet, almost like the opposite has happened. So, do you think also, in a way, the sort of the digital push has also sort of, maybe got, you know, people to enable people to launch blogs, which has then sort of propelled them, into doing print editions. Is there something also in this market as well that mix of sort of digital, but then the craftiness reaction to it? How do you see it?
Yeah, I think that. Particularly in Portland, but I would say that this is probably true of the other West Coast cities and of cities like New York, where there are very strong artisanal cultures, have grown up, that the sort of madcap digitalization, a word I can't even say, let alone wrap my mind around.
You don't need to.
Right.
It's fine.
Of everything and the sort of being declared as though it is as if the battle is over, death of print and all these other, parts of life that were for generations just a feature of culture, being sort of wiped out or swept aside by the digital revolution or whatever you want to call it, has created a counter trend, which jibes very closely with Portland, in Portland in particular, with the focus on the sort of quality of daily life. I mean, I sometimes think of Portland as a city where people are absolutely obsessed with how good their cappuccino is. I mean, or what does their block look like as they walk down it? I mean, these things that maybe don't really show up on anybody's balance sheet and are hard to statistically quantify, and you wouldn't really launch a conventional business or industry model based around it. But that is what a very large number of people here in Portland really care the most about. And I think that's true elsewhere as well. This just happens to be a particular distillation of it. And I think all these magazines are tapping into different facets of that. I mean, all these magazines, while they are coming from similar places, they're all very different. I mean, if you look at what they're talking about, how they're talking about it, they come from very different sensibilities. But they're all speaking to a real concern about what that everyday quotidian experience is and what some of the stories behind the things that really make a difference to everyday experience really are. And journalistically, that's what's interesting about them.
Nathan, I saw you shaking your head at the beginning there as well, when we were sort of talking about whether it's a reaction or not. But how do you see it when you speak to your peers in journalism and on the design side as well? Is it... maybe sort of being this part of the States as well, that people are like, just, okay, enough. Yes, we know about the power of the Valley and the role it plays, but there's almost just a bit of digging in of one's heels, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, the shift from digital to print is something that I've been thinking about as well, because, I mean, every week it seems like there is a new title that's popping up, covering a new, niche category. And to me, it's just, it does remind me of how blogging felt maybe 5 years ago or so, when, it felt much, much easier to publish yourself online and to kind of, get the hang of that. It was maybe a bit unfamiliar, but you could get the hang of it and, get the story out there. I mean, with print, it does seem like the barrier for entry is getting, easier and easier. The cost is getting cheaper as well. And so people are just kind of jumping on it and shifting their blogs, or just, jumping right into a magazine and hopefully giving enough thought to that, because it does seem like some content, some stories, are suited better for online. There's nothing wrong with that, and it doesn't need to be in print to, feel legitimate and to validate that it is actually a proper magazine, a proper blog. And if it does shift to print, it does seem like there needs to be a standard of quality that is expected as well for the readers. And that's something that we've learned from the beginning as well, from our first issue and going forward. There's a quality that's expected, and we've had to kind of, continually step it up if we're willing to, stay in the print arena.
I want to talk about maybe what you grew up with, your points of media influence to arrive at this place. So if we could go back to the Williams household a decade ago or more, what print were you looking at? What did you really like in your childhood? And then, of course, as you moved into your years of higher education, etc.
I mean, magazines around the house growing up were mainstream traditional magazines, Martha Stewart, the Home and Garden, those types of titles. I was never, actually wasn't really into, to magazines and publishing growing up. Even through high school and going through university, I was, I studied business. I was studying economics. I did, subscribe to The Economist and those titles that I read mostly for school and for research and that sort of thing. And it really was just kind of in my last year of university that I really got interested in publishing and kind of the design aspect and art direction, and that's kind of what drove me in that direction.
Zach, you?
Well, I didn't grow up in the prairie provinces, but I did grow up in Montana, which is the next best thing. You know,
pretty much,
South
yeah.
Alberta, basically.
Yeah.
You know, in Missoula, Montana, in the 1970s and 80s when I was growing up, you know, national media arrived very slowly and only a little bit at a time. And so you would get your National Geographic or your Time magazine, and it would almost feel like a dispatch from another planet.
Mm.
You know, a world of activity and ferment and importance that we just didn't have around. You know, we were in a small college town in the middle of the mountains. So I think that sort of, again, fantasy is an inexact word, but that sort of aspect of magazines that provides a glimpse of some other kind of life has been something that stuck with me as something that I really value about the forum ever since, because that's how I was first introduced to it. I mean, my mom would get Vanity Fair, and it was sort of like, it was written in English, but otherwise fairly foreign to our lives.
outer planetary.
Yeah, I mean, it was aspirational for you know, we're relatively smart, cultured people, happen to live in, you know, what many would consider the middle of nowhere. We, of course, recognize that it was the center of the universe, but it was very fascinating to see these glimpses of a life in a different kind of, practically a different kind of civilization, almost. So I think that that's always stuck with me as something that I know that magazines can do.
Mm.
They can capture something, you know. They can show you a kind of life that you may either identify with or just be fascinated by because it's so different than yours.
Mm. I mean, allow me to sort of to stretch the Pacific Northwest as far as Montana, but you know, starting out as a journalist as well, you know, and again being in that environment, how did that inform your worldview? And I mean, now at the point where you're a senior editor. I think when you look at a story, nevertheless, of course, you know, your beat is this city. But do you think you have a different approach? Maybe again, you know, had you started, working for the Weekend Edition for the Washington Post?
Oh, you know, absolutely. My first job in journalism was literally paperboy, and
it's a good place to start.
Yeah, I would drive around in my teenage car filled with the local alternative weeklies, newspapers, and drop them off at all the convenience stores because I was told that was the entry point to becoming a writer.
Hey, it's all about distribution.
Right. So, and my first job was at that weekly in which I had to write about everything from crime to, you know, in the same week I would write a story about a horrific crime that had been committed and the local political controversy and whatever band was playing. I mean, you just had to do everything because there was no one else to do it.
A proper cub reporter.
Yeah, exactly. And I was properly a cub. I was about 21. And maturity-wise, perhaps even younger than that. But the training that gave me, I think, is really different than I would have gotten had I jumped in as a, you know, sort of metro desk reporter at a big newspaper in a big city. I, you know, the sort of broad necessity to write about all kinds of different things. It's kind of still what I do in a way. I mean, I have to edit all kinds of material, and I don't know if I would have steered myself in that direction. Or been steered by whatever mysterious force, but I hadn't had that beginning.
Mm. Maybe we should keep it on a bit of a distribution note. When we were up in Seattle, I was around the university, and I always like to get out and, of course, meet the stores that are, you know, not just selling maybe the most copies, but are certainly doing a very good job of putting our magazine front and center. So I went along to the very, very good Bulldog News, which is on University Way up in Seattle, and talked to a gentleman. Now, you know, he calls himself the inventory manager. At the top of the program, I referred to him as the chief magazine officer of Bulldog News. And I sent along our Nelly Gocheva to have a chat with him.
Bulldog News is Seattle's destination for local, national, international print publications, mostly magazines, also some newspapers, and we have a fair trade coffee bar as well.
So when did you guys start? And can you just walk me through to your history? Because I know you had like a really, really interesting history. You've been around for like nearly 30 years now. At some point, you had 4 venues across Washington State.
That's right.
So can you just like bring us up to date?
Well, after closing 2 stores in the mid-90s, we had a store up here on Capitol Hill, the Shishi neighborhood of Seattle, until 2006. And now we are left with just our flagship store in the University District, which is 30 years on now. We're still surviving.
So tell me, apparently at some point you were doing better than now. if I'm allowed to say that.
Yes.
I guess I am.
Sure.
But like, what happened? Like, how did the market change since? Why did you have to, like, you open three more venues, then you have to close them? What happened?
Well, in the case of Olympia, we had a mutiny of the staff. In Tacoma, there just wasn't the business in the business district to maintain the store. And as far as our Capitol Hill store, we still have a lot of people telling us they wish we had a store up here, but the lease just didn't work out for us. So as far as print goes, I really feel like people that are purists, they desire having access to print media yet, but the market is changing in that everything's going digital. And every time I see an ad on the back of a Condé Nast publication saying that you could see the same thing on an iPad, it really like kills me because that's hurting my business. And that's why I'm so grateful for the feeling people have for Monocle. Not that I'm like doing this for that reason, just saying Monocle has a really great readership in this city. A lot of people believe in its mission to like keep people abreast of like trends in business and in culture. And so it's probably one of our best-selling magazines. I'm not making that up.
So besides Monaco, what sells well for you guys? And how do you select your titles? How do you go for, you know, like what you're going to stock and sell?
What sells well? The Economist, The New Yorker. People still want to get that topical weekly news information, despite the fact that we have a million channels giving us news, you know, every waking second of the day. It's still nice to hold on to, like, to see some really deep down investigative reporting being done yet. Other than that, our biggest growth is found in pop culture magazines and fashion. So we're adding new titles. It's seemingly every week. And we don't necessarily choose what comes in. We have distributors who think something will work for us and they will just send it to us.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you, how do you source your titles? But also, like, what's really important, like you just mentioned The Economist, you talked about Monocle, so it's like kind of British-based magazines. What about local press?
Local, well, I'm happy to report that here in Seattle, there is a, what should I say, like the beginnings of an industry. I have had a few consultations with people looking to start up more respectable publications. One is called Day Night. It's photography based. One is called Pacific Standard. They're both really well done. They're paying a lot of attention to like how they put something together. And from my 15 years of experience in the industry, when I consult, my first point is that you have to appeal to multiple senses. It's not just words on paper anymore. It's feel, it's smell, the type of paper you use, it's formatting, it's font, it's layout. I mean, all of those things add up to whether something's going to be successful or not.
Great. So you said 15 years of experience in the industry. What has changed during these 15 years? And also, like, who buys print in Seattle?
Well, I'm happy to say that the customer base is still as diverse as ever. We are about to start multiple Twitter lines to feed specific interest groups. So I think quality sells. So, I mean, I take in new local publications all the time, like zines. And the ones that don't, it doesn't matter whether you're selling a zine for $2 or $10. What matters is the care you put into it. So if it looks like you don't care, it's not going to sell. So, and then, of course, it has to be about something that people actually care about. I think that's why news magazines have, like, that's shrunk as a genre, but it's improved, I think, in its quality. I think people expect more.
Do you think that the market, just because it's more challenging for print, it's actually a good thing because it makes, like, print publications try harder and ultimately deliver a better quality?
I think it does, yeah. If you're going to be brave enough to start a new print publication, then you have to set your own bar pretty high, and you can see what works already out in shops like mine. On the other hand, the things that I think about that have gone digital only or have folded all together just couldn't keep up with the market forces. I mean, it is a changing world, and a lot of people don't see a positive future for print media.
How do we make them see this positive future?
Keep producing quality publications. Keep focusing on things that people really want to know about. Don't lose hope because you maybe have a couple of months of bad sales. Put in the extra hours, put the quality into the publication, do your research, get it as widely distributed as possible. Just keep plugging away. I mean, that's how you succeed, really.
And that was our Nelly Gocheva talking to Matthew Duckett of Bulldog News up in Seattle. If you get an opportunity, definitely check it out. You're listening to a very special edition of The Stack. We're down the street. We're in Portland, Oregon now. We're coming back right after this.
Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wink Content and is edited by Tyler Brûlé and Andrew Tuck. We have bureau in New York, Toronto, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and Zurich, and a growing network of dedicated correspondents. Monocle 24's headquarters are at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, London. If you'd like to get in touch about sponsorship opportunities, please send an email to vc@monocle.com.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, also with Zach Dundas and Nathan Williams from Kinfolk Magazine. Gentlemen, you've both got pretty decent piles of titles in front of you. I wanted to start with you, Nathan. You've got, you can start where you want. You've got B on top, but you might want to start with something else. Where do you want to go?
Sure, yeah. I've got a Milk Decoration here, which is published out of Paris by the same group that does Milk, which is the luxury children's magazine. And I like it. I mean, flipping through it, it's mostly the photography that I'm looking at because I don't know French. But they do have English
text. This is a dreadful admission as a Canadian. But you're allowed. If you're from Alberta, you're
from
allowed.
The West Coast.
It's fine.
But I mean, for any photo editor, anyone that just appreciates photography, it's a great place to learn the style. It's very consistent. It's very clean. A lot of it's interiors.
Would you say this is part of your monthly diet as well? Something that which is you're always heading out to riches, or it's you've got a subscription to it that you want to keep an eye on?
Well, maybe not Milk Decoration because it's actually just biannually, and this is just their third issue, so they haven't been doing it for very long. But I definitely do appreciate it. Then I've also got B Magazine, like you mentioned, which is actually new to me. I just found it yesterday at a shop in Tokyo, and I guess it's brand imbalance, that's what the B stands for. So every issue, they just really dive into detail on one brand, kind of how they do it, what they're doing well. They contrast it against other brands that are similar in the industry. And so, I mean, anyone that's into brand identity, brand marketing, brand management, it's a great magazine for them. Or anyone that's just, running their own business and trying to maintain and kind of improve their own brand. Reading through and hearing them kind of tear these companies apart, helps you to think of yourself and how you could be doing things better as well.
No, absolutely. I want to come back to that title in a moment. But Zach, you've got T Magazine from the New York Times, a very strong cover. This was last week's edition. Mm-hmm. You have Miuccia Prada, black and white cover, and quite interesting. One might argue it's a cover that could probably only work as a newspaper supplement,
right.
Even though it's got this very this new, some people don't like the new tea, some people love it, but it's got this very strong yellow tea against this very solemn black and white backdrop. I would love to see it on a newsstand myself. Not sure how it would do commercially, but nevertheless, why did you bring that one
in? Well, I brought it because tea has recently had a relaunch of sorts, or a redesign, new editor, new look to it, but mostly because I find it fascinating, and maybe this is another thing that only works as a newspaper supplement and does not work as a newsstand title, but the whole thing is suffused with this kind of loopy sensibility. I mean, the stories, this was also true of another recent tea, that was their travel issue, had some very just eccentric stories, weird stories about people in out of the way places in Morocco and all these kind of things that felt, it doesn't feel as calculated as often American editorial can, especially in
so
fashion.
So you're saying this is a good thing?
Yeah. I think it's great. Whether it works for everybody, I don't know. I mean, I might not be the best litmus test. They might listen to this and think, oh, we've done exactly the wrong thing here. But to me, it's so refreshing because particularly in fashion and travel, a lot of American editorial is very calculated, or feels very driven by the demographic. I mean, you look through the magazine and you can almost tell what the sales mission that informed the particular feature selection is. And this feels quite different to that. I mean, it feels like the expression, what the editors are interested in. It feels like the writers are given a little bit of leeway to just kind of let them, not let themselves go in a bad way, but really express things in a way that they might not get a chance to in another more calculated kind of title.
But do you think that's the direction things need to go? I mean, if the New York Times and its supplement is going to have any type of future, it's going to be able to bring in and also charge the according margins with advertisers, then it really does need to surprise and seem serendipitous, even though, of course, one could sort of argue... Mutual Prada on the cover would probably translate into some ad pages at some point.
Right. Putting Prada on the cover is probably never a bad idea for a fashion magazine. But it's like we were talking about with Kinfolk earlier. It's like you got to have a sensibility. The reverse doesn't seem to be working, right? I mean, all of the titles that seem to be the most troubled on the American newsstand are the most sort of by the book,
right.
Old-fashioned, Newsweek, RIP. Time Magazine, how long do they have left? I don't know.
Yeah.
But and the other sort of traditional big supermarket sellers, just doesn't really seem to work anymore.
Well, and on that note, maybe you want to go to the bottom of this. I'm not sure where Liz reshuffle the stack you've got there, but you do have some of those titles there which are a little bit maybe not entirely supermarket, but certainly a little bit more commercial. And I'm referencing, I think you've got the Smithsonian there.
Yeah, well, I brought that in because the Smithsonian's is funny. It is produced by the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And I like it because it's almost a throwback to what I grew up with National Geographic. It arrives.
Yeah, I think I was given the Smithsonian magazine as a subscription when I was about 10 or 11 or something.
I believe my mother-in-law buys the subscription for us, but I'm not entirely sure.
I thought you were going to say you believed your mother-in-law bought my subscription for me.
Well, she may have done, but the thing arrives. It's beautifully made in many ways. It's well-written. It has no edge to it in the sense that most of magazines are trying to sell you something.
Right.
I mean, you can read an issue of Smithsonian at almost any time. And it is just as valid as when it first came out. And so I like it for that reason in that, is it a solution for the future? I don't know. Mm. But I like it because it sort of recalls an element of magazines that has kind of vanished, which is it is the digest that comes that's full of interesting stuff that's not particularly commercial or trying to hit you over the head with anything.
Okay, I think I'm starting to understand you a bit more, Zach, as well. I think what you're saying from the top of the program as well, you like a bit of a general interest title.
Yeah,
I think, don't you?
I do. Which makes me probably the worst person to have in a focus group if you're trying to design a new magazine.
But
if you
talk about focus group, I want to draw your attention to one story though, which is that this language has definitely changed. I do not recall this type of story when I was receiving this title. So, here we have, a big spread, the Dragon King. You have a Komodo dragon coming out of the sea off, of course, Komodo Island. The Komodo is an all-purpose killing machine, and he's just waiting for you to pay him a visit. Now, this is to me... This was a focus group where they said, okay,
you've got to be more exciting.
You've got to be more edgy. you need some kind of Discovery Channel spin-off that would come from this,
sure,
etc.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand,
but I want to read it. I mean, I want to go to Komodo Island now as well.
That's exactly the thing that the internet is not going to do is hit you with a Komodo dragon when you're not expecting it, right? I mean, you could search for a Komodo dragon and get a million pictures of Komodo dragons, but you can't suddenly find a Komodo dragon.
Yeah, and I think this is an example as well that this is not library photography. I mean, you had to, this took a lot of planning to get this above the surface, below the surface shot of this Komodo dragon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it has a little bit of that, this is for your eighth grade science class feeling to it. I personally don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. That's always been something that magazines have done since the 19th century, and I think there's still a place for it.
Again, you know, appealing to the general interest mm-hmm. in you. I wanted to go back to Nathan. What title do you want to look at next? Do you save Casa Brutus to the end? Because I love Casa Brutus, so I'm not going to let you talk about Casa Brutus right now. So do something
it's
else.
It's just the largest format, so it fit comfortably at the bottom.
Good.
There's Cherry Bomb as well. This is their first issue. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
No, tell us about Cherry Bomb.
It apparently just launched about a month ago.
Can you pass it across?
Yeah.
Thanks.
I noticed that they actually had a Kickstarter to get it going, and they raised about $35,000 for the first issue. And it's a food magazine specifically for women, I guess, for women that work in food stylists. Both of the editors apparently met while working at Harper Bazaar.
Yeah.
And
that would be Carrie Diamond and Claudia Wu.
Okay.
I found that here.
Flipping through the design, the photography, you can kind of get the sense that they were at Harper Bazaar. There's kind of a fashion feel to it. Mm-hmm. That first issue, I think the gal on the front cover is she's a supermodel, and so, it's just another angle, another way to approach kind of food. Guess.
Mm. I mean, how do you feel when you look at something like this? And I guess when you look at, and you're of course referencing, you know, the surge in all of these titles suddenly, and you know, in many ways, you're very much sort of at the forefront of this current boom. Are you looking at it on one side to keep you on your toes? I mean, to my question is accurately, I mean, having, you know, competition is a good thing. This is not direct competition, but you know, they're fighting in the same trenches as you are every day. Or are you also like looking for inspiration and other things? Of course, you're not going to lift anything out of that. But I'm wondering how do you observe it? Because I think it's always a good question to ask editors. You know, is it work or is it a pleasure?
Some of these titles like Cherry Bomb, I'll read more as work. I mean, I'd like to make sure that there's not very much overlap with the kind of stories that they're covering. Even the contributors, the photographers that they're working with, I kind of see it as respect to our readership, that we do keep Kinfolk different, that we're not double dipping in too many areas and covering the same things. That's why I would pick up Cherry Bomb. And flipping through it, I did sense and feel that it definitely is targeted to another audience mm. that I'm not in. And so it may be the last issue that I do buy. But to see them popping up, part of it is encouraging. It's nice to know that there is interest, that there is a market for it. I mean, assuming that they, you know, that they last, you know, past their third or fourth issue.
Is that critical third issue?
That's encouraging. And at the same time, there is a positive competition that comes with it, that kind of that edge where we do feel like we do need to keep innovating and coming up with fresh, good ideas. If all these food titles weren't popping up, we might get a little too comfortable and lazy in our office. Mm.
So. I mean, for you, and not giving away your business plan, you are now, I mean, you're backed by one of Europe's biggest private publishers. I guess the Bonniers are your publishing partner, I guess, via their acquisition in the States, if I read the masthead correctly.
Up until our last issue, now we're publishing independently.
So you're fully cut loose again.
Yes.
And was that good to have, you know, in the early days, and I sort of, you know, and this is why I want to explore it slightly, to have a bit of a, maybe not a finishing school, but to have sort of the power of a big player to sort of learn the ins and outs, and then to go and, you know, cut your teeth and chart your own course.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely more mentoring. I mean, they helped us, they taught us how to work with distributors. You know, we're publishing through Book Trade, so it's different, it's slow. But it definitely wasn't, you know, being backed by anything. I mean, there was no financial support
right.
at all. And it was more of a take relationship than a give in many aspects. Mm. But it did, I mean, it was crucial for us to get started with distribution and all of that. So mm. it was definitely worthwhile.
Before we go, I would love to sort of hear more about where things go. And as I said, it's just... Well, maybe let's discuss it now. Asia and the excitement, you know, that the Japanese have, and I mean we've seen it with Monocle as well. You know, how quickly that market, you know, will jump on something and really sort of want to, you know, to run with it. Was that, you know, always part of your business plan, or were you surprised also just at how much Asia has really gone for in the way that they have, you know? And yeah. And probably you go to many pockets of the United States where people probably would not know your brand in the same way mm-hmm. that if you went to the streets of Daikanyama, they would.
Right. No, that was a huge surprise for us. Just since the beginning and since, you know, over the last year with a bit more growth, there's been a particular interest from Japanese readers. And, I mean, just this last week, we launched a Japanese language edition of Kinfolk with the publisher that's locally there in Tokyo. And we're still, I mean, we're running with it. We're really, you know, gearing up with our readers there in Japan, but still also just trying to figure out what it is and why they're so keen on, you know, good publishing and print products and things that are made well.
Mm. And you brought Casa Brutus, which is probably almost one of the last times we probably talk about on this program before we go. Why did you bring it in? What appeals to you aside from its substantial format?
I mean, this particular issue, I think it's themed for kitchens, like sharing kitchens. And so flipping through it, there's a lot of interior shots of just the different styles, the different, you know, appliances that they use. And it just seemed like a really fresh perspective to me. Specifically being in Tokyo and Japan, I think that's where it's published. It seems like there's a focus on function and the proper use of a small space, which isn't always what you'd find in interior magazines here in the States. So that was fun for me to look through.
Mm. I thought you were going to say because our kitchen was in it as well. But it wasn't that.
I did notice that.
You were in tea not long ago, so it's all...
I was in tea. Yeah, you're right, actually.
It all comes back.
It does.
Yeah.
I'm going to give last title to you. What do you want to talk about? Should we talk about maybe, you know, shameless promotion? Should we look at your current cover? We can
talk about it. You know, the
I like this cover very
much.
We're talking about the Portland Monthly.
This cover was the work of all of 3 hours of our art department. They had a one of these behind the scenes panic situations where the cover that they had produced,
some of the best covers come together this way.
It wasn't working, and they came to the realization that was the case late. They threw together this photo shoot.
Are these your friends on the front cover?
They're not my friends, sadly. But if they want to be my friends, we could talk it over. It just captures something about summer in Portland, which is, as anyone who's been to the Pacific Northwest knows, it's fleeting.
I was going to say that, but it looks like, you know, it's a very sort of, you know, honey, sun-kissed place. As it says, Portland Monthly Summer Guide, festivals, picnics, Shakespeare, cocktails, concerts, naked bike rides.
Yes, we've been. Yes,
yes, that's happening today, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
What more do you want? Well, you can also get ultimate breakfast taco, kayaking the region's wildest river, show off your city, 5 perfect Portland days.
Right. Talk about a general interest title, right?
All in 138 pages.
Right.
I think that is great value.
Yeah, we're packing it in.
And what a note to end this special edition of The Stack. I want to say a very huge thanks to Nathan Williams. Congratulations on everything you've done with Kinfolk. Absolutely brilliant. And enjoy the delights of independence. Having no nets and wires, occasionally frightening and scary. And Zach Dundas, always great to, of course, have you at one end of a phone line, but good to see you across the table as well.
Yes, thank you.
Today's show was produced by David Pleasant, also Tom Edwards, who has been my sidekick up and down this coast, has also been looking after things, and also Toby Hammond is around the table here at the Ace Hotel. Huge thanks to everyone at the Ace Hotel here in Portland for looking after us. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's program, do drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're going to be around next week. It's our country fair in London. So please make your way to our fair city for that. So I will be, of course, kicking things off that morning and then running out, throwing on my apron, looking after Mono Chan. And I think I'm not sure what I think I'm doing the tombola. I'm running something like that. You can always listen again via iTunes or at monocle.com. But for now, for me, Tyler Burleigh, have a very good weekend. Goodbye.